Hey, everybody, and welcome to the NFL Roadshow. Lindsay Rhodes here, finally settled into a normal offseason pace with free agency and the trade market having settled down a little bit. So that means that we now have some time and space to shift gears and dive into the draft. And we'll get to some of the larger themes as we get a little bit closer to the date, first round scheduled for April 28th. The pivot points, the strategies, team needs, mocks, that kind of stuff. For now, though, I thought it would be helpful to go through some of the position groups one at a time so that we can really focus on understanding the specifics before we start talking about them in a macro sense. And we're going to start with the offensive line, which is a unit that typically accounts for quite a few first-round picks, especially at the tackle spot. 36 tackles in the first round in the last 10 years. That trails only wide receiver, defensive end, and cornerback in terms of positions that have gone in the first round. What makes a good tackle? How do you know that someone is a tackle instead of a guard? What do we tend to get wrong about the position in terms of projections? Who are the best people in this year's class? Where might they go? Which teams? Where, like in terms of draft position also? And then in a wider sense, what's the best way to allocate your resources at the position? You guys know I love roster building, and I'm interested to discuss that with regard to the O-line group. What we should take away from the Bengals playoff run, because I think you could pretty much spin that either way, right? They lost the Super Bowl because they were weak on the line, but also they made it to the Super Bowl with a weak line. So what should we make of that? And then with regard to the people already in the NFL playing well, who are the very best? Because I know most of us could rattle off 10 receivers that we like off the top of our head and have detailed analysis and debates about it. But how many of us really know how to judge center play in the NFL? Well, my guest today does. His name is Brandon Thorne. He is an O-line scout and evaluator who works for Bleacher Report and Establish the Run. He actually analyzes the defensive line also for them. He is the scouting coordinator for O-Line Masterminds, which if you are unfamiliar, it's an incredible summit for offensive linemen that Duke Manyweather started up a few years back. A bunch of offensive linemen at various levels in the NFL, you know, all pros, Pro Bowls, you know, guys that play the position across the league, and then also in college, all get together and they exchange ideas. And it's a really cool thing that Manyweather has started at like Luke Johnson's suggestion. Anyway, Brandon's involved with that. He also has a Substack called Trench Warfare, where he has recently broken down film with Rashawn Slater and Zion Johnson, one of the guards in this year's draft, who you will hear him talk about quite a bit in this episode. He's one of his favorite guys that is available. So I hope you enjoy the conversation. Let's go ahead and get to it. It's time now to break the huddle.
Hurry up, let's go!
Two on two. Ready? Three.
Brandon, so I just ran through your bio, and I'm curious to know how you got into doing what you do. How'd you land in this space?
Yeah. I think it, so my love of football starts back when I was a kid playing Madden. You know, that's kind of what laid the foundation for me, just learning rosters. And, you know, I remember Madden, the new Maddens came out in like July or August. So once the season ended, you know, in January, February, there was like a 5-month period where the rosters were old. So I would create most of the first round of the draft and create a player. I would sign and cut every guy, change numbers, and just, and so I did that for 10 years or so up until I was, you know, in my 20s. And that really helped me learn roster building and like the NFL, just different players. And so, and then in high school, I played offensive line. I was, you know, pretty big then. So I just naturally kind of got moved there against my will in a way. And that helped me kind of just gain an appreciation for it because I had to take pass sets and I had to try to block these ridiculous athletes. Because I mean, even high school, I still saw a lot of Division I guys, and I grew up in Florida. So high school football there is pretty big. So that kind of gave me an appreciation for the trenches and offensive line. And then I joined the military after high school, and I was in the Air Force for 10 years. And during my whole Air Force career, I was still an avid NFL fan. I started reading biographies. I started just getting deeper into it. And I had an opportunity to get out early because they were downsizing at the time. And I figured, man, I had just gotten married and my wife was supportive of it. And I was 27 or so, 26. And I was like, man, if I'm going to do this, I got to do it. So I got out and I pursued NFL scouting. I wanted to be an NFL scout. And I just went 100% into it. And doors opened for me. I mean, it was just amazing. I was in Colorado at the time, stationed there. And Ted Sundquist, former general manager of the Broncos, lived 20 minutes from me, and he was an Air Force veteran. So he was on Twitter, and I reached out to him, and I noticed he had a website, and I was like, hey, you don't have any scouting reports on here. Can I write for you for free? You know? And he's like, yeah, sure. So I showed up to a speaking engagement that he had in Colorado Springs, and I just like met him randomly. And we started talking, and I started working for him. We did a podcast, and we had on all these guests, and it was amazing. It was like a dream come true. And he just taught me a lot about the league and, you know, team building and all that kind of stuff. And through that, I got introduced to LeCharles Bentley, former NFL offensive lineman who trains players in Arizona. And then I started talking to him, and I went to his inaugural clinic in 2016, where he brought in offensive line coaches from around the country, and he allowed me to come there. I wasn't a coach. I just wanted to learn. So I went down there doing that, and that kind of gave me, you know, just fed that love I had of the trenches and offensive line, learning about the intricacies of it. And at kind of around the same time, I joined Twitter and realized nobody was really doing offensive line analysis. And I was like, man, this is like kind of an untapped, you know, area that I could maybe, you know, get into and create a niche. So I started to become active on Twitter, posting my scouting reports with Ted on there. And just, you know, I went to Senior Bowls on behalf of Ted and his website at the time. Another big kind of stepping stone for me was something called the Scouting Academy. So that's an online-based scouting curriculum designed by former NFL scouts, NFL coaches. And you basically sign up, do modules for positions. And I did like quarterback, receiver, linebacker, offensive, defensive line. And that gave me a framework to study the position, traits to look for, and most importantly, how to convey my thoughts on paper in a, like a really concise way, in a duplicatable way. So that's what I still use today. Like the note taking that I learned there, I do the scouting terms that I learned then, I do today. So that gave me a process. And it just led to more open doors. I mean, I scouted for the Senior Bowl for a couple of years for Phil Savage when he was running it. And man, just I got an interview with the New York Jets. Didn't wind up getting the job or anything, but that was a really great experience for me. And just over time, just the media thing kept growing. So I just focused on that. And about 2 years ago, I started my own Substack. And I've been writing for Bleacher Report for a couple of years. I've wrote for a lot of sites over the years for free. And now for the last couple of years, it's been full time. And there's some other stuff along the way that's happened, but that's kind of a big overview and step-by-step process of how I've gotten here.
What have you learned about scouting offensively? So you focus primarily on the trenches, both sides of the ball, O-line, D-line. What have you learned about scouting those positions since obviously you played it? So there were things that you were familiar with. You're familiar with like the basics of how to play the position, maybe even at a high level. But then once you get to this elite level, in terms of the intricacies and the things that you're looking for, what has that changed? How has your eye changed in that regard?
Oh, man. I would say kind of generally, I think how much is dependent on everything that's around you as an offensive lineman in terms of the scheme, what you're being asked to do, the level of coaching that you're getting, how good and how cohesive the unit is. So I'm trying to watch a player, but you have to look at, you know, if you're watching a left guard, you know, you kind of want to take a peek at the left tackle. You want to see the center, the two guys that he's in between, and how good of players are they? And then also the opponent is really important as well. I feel like, you know, oftentimes people are scouting players, but they don't pay very close attention to the opponent. And I've Dan Hatman, one of my mentors with the Scouting Academy, he said something years ago that stuck with me. He said when he sits down to scout an offensive or defensive lineman, he always starts watching, say he's watching the left tackle, he'll start watching the defensive end first and he'll scout him first. And then he'll start watching the actual guy he's trying to, you know, write a report on.
Like, what's he bringing to the table? And then how does this guy handle it? Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Like, what caliber of player is this guy? How is he winning? You know, and then maybe do a little research on him. Like, what's his production? And, you know, kind of just learn about him a little bit, kind of scout him. And then when you watch the offensive lineman, you just have that much more context, and it just helps you build a more accurate evaluation of the guy. So I would say quality of opponent is really important as well. I think those are kind of the main things that I've learned. And then, you know, back to how dependent everything is on everything around them as an offensive lineman, like one of the big things is in pass protection. Sacks, for instance, people think, okay, this offensive lineman gave up a sack. I think oftentimes it's actually the fault of the quarterback. And that's something, you know, it's all tied together. So, you know, even if a guy technically gives up a sack, if the quarterback held on the ball too long or drifted in the pocket or got too deep in the pocket, you know, that could just be on him. So it's like, you can't always assign blame to where you think it is on the surface. Oftentimes it's dependent on other parts. So yeah, it's just, there's so many other factors that you have to try to consider. I think it's with all positions, but specifically with offensive line, those are some of the factors that I've learned to consider when you're trying to evaluate a guy.
I forget who it was. I want to say it was one of the Schwartz brothers, maybe during the season, that went into that hard and created video evidence, and they brought it, you know, we're fighting with people on Twitter about when a sack was attributable to the offensive lineman. What is a reasonable amount of time to expect an offensive lineman to block his guy before the sack actually, you know, is on the other guy?
Yeah. And part of that is dependent on the concept, you know, how deep the routes are. And, you know, that's a big part of it. But I would say generally, like, under 3 seconds, you know, is kind of a general time frame that you ideally want the ball out. And I've actually learned this from Jeff Schwartz. I've talked to Mitchell and Jeff quite a bit, fortunately. And Jeff actually said kind of a standard rule for depth for a quarterback is like 9 to 9.5 yards behind the line of scrimmage. So if the quarterback drops it deeper than 9.5 yards, most of the time, any pressure that he sees is on him. He just has to deal with it, because the angles at that point for the tackles, especially, it just becomes very difficult to block an edge rusher past 9.5 yards. You can't really expect him to do that. So timing is important, and I would say depth of the drop is very important as well.
Let me ask you this about scouting too, and this might be a really stupid question. As somebody who's, you know, not super familiar with the weeds of actually playing an offensive line position, how much variation do you see in terms of the way they actually play? Like, there are specific techniques and things that, you know, the balance and the hands and that kind of stuff, are there different? And I know that strengths will be different. Some people will be better, you know, run blocking than pass blocking or whatever. That's not what I mean. I mean, in terms of the actual technique, how much variation is there from offensive lineman to offensive lineman? Do you primarily play the position similarly and then you just have different strengths, or are there guys who go about it completely differently?
I would say generally you kind of play it the same way and they have different strengths, but there are always outliers and there's players that go at it totally differently. Like, I would say, you know, Mitchell Schwartz is a pretty good example of this when he played with the Chiefs and even going back to the Browns. You look at him on paper in terms of raw athletic ability and he's not athletic. He's one of the least athletic offensive tackles in the NFL when he was playing. One of like the bottom five probably starters in the
league. He's not going to like this setup.
No, we talk about it and like he'll laugh about it. He's good about laughing at himself with it. And that's what makes his career so much more impressive, because not that you need a lot of athletic ability to play offensive line. Obviously, there's a certain baseline that you would like. But for him to be such an outlier on the negative side, he had to be very efficient with how he moved. The timing of, in terms of getting off the ball, was pristine with him. He knew when to get off the ball. He understood his body very well. He played with very good leverage, so he never got too high. He was very good with his hands in terms of timing, you know, his strikes. And his footwork was just very efficient. He didn't get off balance. So, you know, you put him on a short shuttle or a three cone or a vertical jump or a broad jump, and the raw explosiveness and quickness isn't there. But when you put the pads on and you put him on the field, he's just he just had a keen understanding of how to put himself in good positions constantly. So he was kind of a really fun guy for me to study. And it taught me a lot because he was so technically sound, and he didn't win with these, you know, physical gifts necessarily. So, you know, and he was a multiple time all pro. So it was just, he was one of those guys who was an outlier to me. Trying to think of some other guys. There's some bigger guys who can win differently. I remember a guy for the Jaguars named Jeremy Parnell. He's kind of like a mid-level starter, played right tackle. He was huge. You know, another thing I do, sidebar, is I volunteer my time with, now I'm employed by them, Offensive Line Masterminds. Mm. So I do that, and I've been doing that for 4 or 5 years in the summer. It's coming up in July. And that's basically a get together with offensive linemen around the league, you know, upwards of 50 guys. So I get to sit in on these rooms. Yeah, it's incredible. And you hear the thought processes of all these guys. And Parnell was there. So I got to hear kind of how he approached it and everything. And he was unique because in pass protection, I just talked to Rashawn Slater for a film room, for instance, and he kind of approaches it much different than a guy like Jeremy Parnell. Rashawn Slater is much more, I would say, technically kind of savvy with what he does. Parnell, because he was so big, long, and strong, he could just attack guys. So he would take a pass set and then just try to basically punch them as hard as he could with two hands. And it's risky because if you miss, you lose quickly. But if you connect, you're going to stun that guy, the pass rusher. So like, that's a good example, kind of that dichotomy there of him and Rashawn Slater. They approach it totally different ways, but they can be, you know, pretty effective. You know, Rashawn, obviously all pro as a rookie. Parnell was never an all pro, but he carved out a pretty impressive career playing a very unique way. And a lot of that's contingent on, like, you know, scheme and stuff like that, but also just size and strength, you know? So, yeah, I mean, it's fascinating to all the different guys I've studied over the years. There's so many different ways to go about it at the same time.
You mentioned coaching earlier as, you know, something that you're looking for too in your overall evaluation. Who is doing that particularly well? Like, where is, what colleges are coaching up their offensive linemen pretty consistently? Like, you know, you're going to get somebody that's ready. And then who in the NFL is also developing guys very well?
Yeah, I mean, well, NFL, just Bill Callahan is kind of like on the Mount Rushmore, I think, of offensive line coaches. He's with the Browns right now. He's been in various places in his career. And with him and just with all these coaches, what I look at is I like to look at their bio and see where they've been, and then to, you know, see what players played for them, and then try to compare how those players played for them compared to other coaches and other places. And you start to see a reoccurring theme of Bill Callahan, Mike Munchak, Jeff Stoutland with the Eagles, and, you know, Dante Scarnecchia before he retired. Those were some of the top guys. Aaron Cromer. You just kind of see when players get under their tutelage, you know, they maximize what they do well, and they put them in positions to succeed. You see Pro Bowls, you see, you know, all pros, or just success on film. You know, you see guys playing in unison with one another, being on the same page, being very efficient and things like that. So those are some NFL coaches that you constantly see get the most out of guys. College wise, I would say, you know, Notre Dame is a big one. When they had Harry Heinstead, you know, he's back now. He kind of was away there for a couple of years, but he's back. Wisconsin is always a great offensive line to watch. They're well coached. I would throw out Boston College the last couple of years. Their offensive line coach just got hired with the Dolphins, but they were really fun to watch. Alabama, Georgia. Trying to think. There's a couple others I'm probably forgetting. Generally, SEC is great to watch because they have so many NFL caliber offensive and defensive linemen. That's what makes the SEC great, really. People think it's skill positions like receivers and quarterbacks. It's the offensive and defensive line. I mean, they're so deep. They can rotate guys. They have 4 and 5 star guys on the bench. And they just have so many NFL caliber guys. And they oftentimes are running NFL concepts, like a multiple run game. They're not doing a lot of basic inside zone RPO heavy offenses. They're doing like other concepts like duo and outside zone and power and counter. So they have these, like, you get to study guys that are going to be doing things that they're going to be asked to do at the NFL level. And that just makes evaluation so much easier. There's not a lot of projection. So those are some programs I would say.
What about the guys who are not in programs like that? You know, like from an evaluation standpoint, how does that complicate things? Is that how you end up with? And I know that you get this question all the time, like, who's a day three guy? You know, like who's a, you know, if you could fully isolate a day three guy, it'd be a day one guy, right? Like, so it's always a funny question to a degree, but is that how you come to that conclusion? Like, I haven't seen it, but there are pieces there, but they just weren't asked to do the things that I want them to do.
Yeah. I mean, that's a big part of it. Oftentimes it's like physical markers in terms of height, weight, arm length, you know, maybe they're just undersized. But I mean, I'm looking at my list now of like day three guys I like in this draft. And I would say it's a lot of these guys, what makes them stand out or why they're not day one guys. Like I said, the physical traits, maybe they're lacking there a little bit. They don't have those ideal measurements. And that's why the bigger schools pass them up. But when you watch them on film, they're either very good fundamentally. They're either fundamentally sound, technically sound, playing with good leverage and things like that. They know how to manipulate blocks and, you know, maintain their center of gravity, and they play with good balance and all these kind of nuanced things that they just learn or they're natural at. Maybe they were really good wrestlers. Maybe they threw the shot put and discus and they're able to create torque, you know, in the run game. There's so many different things. And a lot of times with smaller school guys, you want to see them dominate. If they're not dominant at lesser level football, like low level D1 or Division 2, then chances are they're not going to be NFL guys. So you really want to see them dominate. Like one guy at a smaller school in this class is Cole Strange, for instance. He's at the University of Tennessee, Chattanooga. So small school. And when I watched film on him this year, he had one game against the SEC. So that game was like, oh man, I got to watch this one, you know, because mm-hmm. he's the step up in competition. They played Kentucky. So I watched that tape and he looked like he belonged. Not only that, he was actually taking it to some of these SEC defensive linemen, driving them back, putting them on the ground, frustrating them, showing him that he's as strong, if not stronger. And when you see a guy like that at a small school, and even if it's just one game, because that's all you have, I mean, that carries a lot of weight. And then he went to the Senior Bowl and he's against all these good players and he's showing it there. So then it's like, okay, what he showed on that film against Kentucky, that wasn't a fluke, you know? So there's a lot of guys like that over the years that jump out to me. And that's one in this class who I like, you know, maybe late day two, early day three is like Cole Strange.
I mean, you're drafting potential, obviously, up and down the board, maybe more so there in the late round, something that you haven't seen or something that's harder to project. At the top, what do you need to see? Like, what differentiates one of the best offensive linemen specifically from a guy like that? It's the guy that checks every box, or are there still boxes that are unchecked that you're comfortable with?
Usually they check, you know, pretty much every box you want to see. I think of a guy who plays a similar position on the interior. Cole Strange is a guard center. My top guard in the draft, for instance, first round grade for me is Zion Johnson from Boston College. And with him, obviously better competition week in, week out. So that helps. His scheme is a little bit more translatable to the pro system. I mentioned Boston College being one of those college programs that, you know, are one of the best for offensive line. Their offensive line coach obviously was very good at what he was doing. All the offensive linemen, the way they played, the technique they used was very good. It looked like you were watching an NFL offensive line in a lot of ways. Zion's bigger as well. Cole Strange is, you know, barely 300 pounds. Zion Johnson is like 315, 320. So that is, you know, pretty significant difference. So you got to see him play better players. You got to see him probably, you know, in a more translatable scheme. He was executing blocks that are, you know, more translatable to the pro game. So, I mean, just those two things right there are huge. And I think he also is like stronger, you know, and has more kind of traits that you would want from an offensive guard than a guy like Cole Strange. Whereas Cole Strange is very athletic. He has flashes of strength, but it's not super consistent. And he's not as technically advanced as a guy like Zion Johnson. So it's a lot of different things, but that's hopefully that kind of gives you an idea of like what separates those two guys for me.
How would you describe this year's draft crop on the offensive line?
I would say it's probably above average overall. I think the tackle group is very strong on the, it's like very high end in terms of like first round guys. There's probably going to be, you know, five, maybe six first round tackles. After that, I think, you know, it's not as deep, I don't think, as the interior, but that's oftentimes the case because there's three interior positions and only two tackle positions. So there's just a larger pool of players on the interior. So I think typically most often interior is just a little bit deeper, like on day two, day three, just because tackles, it's a supply demand thing. The supply for offensive tackles just is not as high as offensive guards because it requires more athletic ability to play offensive tackle. And big guys who are also athletic, there's just not a lot of those guys walking the planet who can play offensive line. Interior, you don't have to be quite as athletic. You can get by more on smarts, more on quickness and, you know, like tricks of the trade, technique, fundamentals, things like that. Offensive tackle, you could win that way, but you most oftentimes need a little bit, you need to be a little bit more gifted. It's just the way it is. So that's why I think most often in the draft, tackles go first, tackles go higher if there's a good group. And then interior is a little bit more day two, day three, because you can get more of those guys easier. So, and that's how I see this class. I mean, interior wise, there's for me just two first round grades. That's Tyler Linderbaum and Zion Johnson. Mm-hmm. A lot of people might have Kenyon Green as a first round grade, but I have him in the second. So two interior guys, and then offensive tackle wise, I have three. I'm not quite as high, you know, on as the consensus. And then there's two guys who are definitely one. Trevor Penning is going to go in the first round. He might even go top 10. I have more of a fringe first round grade on him. And then Bernard Raymond is another guy who could go in the first, but he might be a second round grade. So, and of course the top three are Evan Neal, Ike Mekwonu, and Charles Cross. So those five names, I think four of those guys are going to go in the first round, maybe five. And I have three with first round grades and two with fringe first round grades, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. How would you rank those three that are definite first rounders in your mind? Neal and Cross and how do you say his name? Last name?
Ikem Ekwonu or Ike.
Okay. Ike. I'm going to go with Ike.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ekwonu.
He's his nickname.
I can do Ekwonu. Okay.
Yeah. Ekwonu. Yeah. So Evan Neal and Ekwonu to me are the top two. And it's really about like they're in the same tier for me. So it's kind of pick your flavor depending on what you need, you know, your scheme, the state of your offensive line, your coaching staff, that kind of thing. To me, it's a toss up. So I would probably lean right now Evan Neal over Ekwonu because I think he's a little bit more polished. He's a guy who could come in and probably fit more schemes, more roles. Whereas Ekwonu is, he has higher upside. So here's another way of saying it. I think Ekwonu's run blocking is better than any other offensive lineman in the draft's run blocking and any offensive lineman's pass blocking. So Ekwonu's trait in the run game, his explosive power, his ability to move people and, you know, stay attached to blocks and fit any scheme is better than anything else any offensive lineman does in the class. However, his pass blocking needs some refinement in terms of technique. He's going to be a little bit more higher variance there. So that's why I have him a little bit below Neal, whereas Neal's a little bit more well-rounded. So yeah, again, it's really, you know, you could go either way there. And then Charles Cross, the reason for me why he's three is because of the system that he comes from is the air raid, which is a heavy pass spread offense. Mike Leach is, you know, the coach of Mississippi State. So what that does for offensive line is it makes the job a little bit easier because they play with increased splits. So meaning they're further away from each other on the offensive line. So what that does is when they're playing pass rushers, they're closer to the pass rush. So they don't have to deal with as much space. So it kind of boxes the rushers in a little bit. It's not to say that he doesn't see wide nine alignments where pass rushers are really far outside of him and he has to get to a spot in space and that's very difficult. He does it well. He's very gifted physically. He has all the physical traits you could want. But I think the adjustment to the pro game for him will be a little bit more steep than the other two based on what he was asked to do in college. So that's why I have him with kind of a mid first round grade, whereas Neal and Ekwonu I have closer to the top 10. But, you know, very good players, you know, all of them, obviously. So that's how I would rank those top three.
So if you're looking at the actual draft and the teams and the order that they pick in, where do you see the first tackle in this case coming off the board?
Well, I was going to say, you know, prior to a couple weeks ago, the Jaguars had a chance of maybe taking one of these guys. But now with what they've done on the offensive line, it seems like they're probably going to go pass rusher. Probably Aiden Hutchinson would be my guess there. So that's like probably a small chance. After that, I mean, I could see the Texans potentially picking an offensive lineman. Mm-hmm. They haven't really been mocked picking one very often from what I've seen. But
not at three anyway, right?
Not at three, right?
Yeah. More at 13, so, maybe.
Yeah, yeah. That's probably where you would see it more if you read a lot of mock drafts. But I wouldn't, I mean, they need help on the offensive line. They have Laremy Tunsil at left tackle, but other than that, you know, I mean, I like Titus Howard as well as a, you know, a solid starter, but you could put Evan Neal or Ikem Ekwonu at right tackle or at a guard spot. Not that you want to necessarily pick a guard three overall, but yeah, they could do it. And then the Jets and the Giants, I would be shocked if Neal, Ekwonu, or even a guy like Trevor Penning, who I think the NFL really, really likes, they're all in play in one of those four or five spots. I would lean Ekwonu or Neal first, with Penning kind of an outside shot. So yeah, for me, it's 4, 5, 6 are the sweet spots for offensive linemen because all those teams need it, especially the Giants and the Panthers. So those are the two teams that I'm really looking at getting one of those guys, if not both.
What if the Seahawks went O-line at 9?
Oh, I can definitely see that.
Which of those guys would be the best fit for them? You were talking about the run blocking that literally made me like my eye went to 9 there. but if he's not as strong as a pass blocker, then that's obviously an area of concern in Seattle also. So who would be a good fit? Who could you see Seattle specifically liking?
I could see Charles Cross. That would probably be his highest slotting that I would go. That's kind of where it would start with him, I would think. But yeah, I mean, Seattle, you know, they have a guy named Stone Forsythe who they picked in the 6th round last year. I actually liked him more than a 6th round pick, but he's probably more of like a backup kind of guy. Dwayne Brown is obviously a free agent, so they need a left tackle. They probably need a right tackle as well. So they need both tackle spots, at least, you know, a high level starter in there. So assuming Neal's gone, assuming Ekwonu is gone, Even if Penning's on the board, I would think they would favor Cross just because of just kind of his physical traits, athletic ability. Penning's athletic as well, but I think Cross would fit their style a little bit more. They're more of like a kind of a zone run game, which I'm assuming they're going to still run. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I would think Charles Cross would be my first name that I would put at Seattle there.
In terms of what they need to do what they want to do offensively, could you see them valuing that more than quarterback there? Because they clearly need to come out of this draft with a quarterback, in my opinion.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it depends on if, you know, the guy they want's on the board. I would assume that Malik Willis is going to be the first quarterback taken in the class. And I've heard, you know, based on just stuff you see on Twitter from reporters and people in the know, that like Detroit could pick him at two. But if no quarterback is taken, you know, up until that point, I think that Malik Willis would be definitely a guy they would look at before offensive line. But if Malik Willis is gone, I would think, you know, if Charles Cross is on the board there, that I would probably lean that way over any other quarterbacks myself. But yeah, I guess it just depends if they fall in love with somebody.
Who breaks the seal for the interior offensive lineman? Is that the Ravens at 14?
Oh, I could see that. Yeah. I mean, them, man. Yeah. I wouldn't be shocked if them or Pittsburgh, you know, I would say probably the lowest at 20. But yeah, I mean, I could see 14 Baltimore. Yeah, who do they have? They have Kevin Zeitler still, so they have that right guard spot.
What about center? What about Linderbaum? Yeah,
from what I've seen, Eric DaCosta loves Tyler Linderbaum, their GM. I mean, that would be, you know, pretty high for him, but he's a really good player. It's just size stuff with him. The thing with him is, you know, he weighed 290 at Iowa. He showed up to the combine, you know, heavier, but he didn't work out because he still has a foot sprain. So we didn't get to see him work out at the heavier weight. And I don't think he's working out at his pro day. So he just kind of has that unanswered question of how much can he weigh and still function at the level we saw on tape. Mm. And then he also has very short arms, which isn't like a, you know, like a back-breaking thing, but it is just kind of like, you know, just one of those things that if you're picking top 15, a center, he's a center only guy. He doesn't have position versatility, isn't a huge deal either, but still.
Not if you're looking for a center.
Yeah, right. I mean, yeah, exactly. So I really like Linderbaum still. I still have a pretty high first round grade on him. That would make sense to me, but I'm just kind of trying to play devil's advocate too of what I've heard. But yeah, I definitely think Tyler Linderbaum could go to Baltimore, and he fits kind of their play style. His competitive toughness is outstanding and he's explosive. He would definitely be a weapon in the run game. So I could see Linderbaum going there. And then I think Zion Johnson will probably be the first guard off the board in the draft, especially because he's aced all the offseason stuff, combine, Senior Bowl, and his tape is really good. So like Arizona at 23, maybe Pittsburgh at 20. Those are a couple teams. And then I think the dream scenario for Zion Johnson is 24 to Dallas. I think that would be a perfect fit. That'd be amazing.
Get another good guard. Come on.
I know.
Stop hogging them all.
I know. Dallas fans are so spoiled.
The Steelers at 20, I think, are tricky. I put them and the Seahawks kind of in the same category, right? Like the Steelers, I've been banging the table. I mean, last year I was frustrated that they didn't address the offensive line. And so I kind of am going into this year's draft, like, do it. But then now they have this glaring need at quarterback. And I don't know how they view that position after bringing in Trubisky, if they'll think like that's okay and we can do this, or we have to get a quarterback in this year's draft to build around for the future.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, obviously Malik Willis will probably be gone, I would think, but maybe like a Desmond Ridder, or if they like Kenny Pickett, you know, maybe one of those guys they pick there. I wouldn't be shocked, you know, to see that at all.
Yeah. I could see them going either direction, their O-line or quarterback. Going back to the tackles for a second, how do you know someone has what it takes to play offensive tackle in the NFL? Because I know we talk a lot about the arm length and like how you, you know, can tell the difference between a tackle and a guard physically. Oftentimes they just look different. But there's also a lot of talk around draft time about guys that could be moved to guard that have played tackle in the NFL. And, how do you know when someone is definitely a tackle? And how do you know when this is a guy that maybe has played tackle, but you want to play him at guard?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I've picked the brains of some people on this over the years. And I think I've come to the kind of the point where I think to stay at tackle, you want to see reps where they're pass blocking on an island without help, whether it be slide protection, chip, alignment, and blocking high level edge rushers that are aligned wide, like wide nine. You know, because you're going to see that in the NFL. I mean, on money downs, on high leverage situation, passing downs in the NFL, they're going to put edge rushers far outside of you, and you can't help both sides, obviously. So one of your tackles is going to have to set out and show the foot quickness, the range, and just the ability to hit a landmark again in that scenario. So you want to, you know, kind of dig through the tape of a guy and see him in those situations and see how he does. Fortunately for a guy like Evan Neal, he plays at Alabama, so we get to see him do that a lot against high level competition. And, you know, so that to me is huge. It's the pass protection element of it and seeing them execute in those situations, because those are the biggest, like the most meaningful situations that you're going to be in as an NFL tackle. So if you can see those on tape in college and confirm that they can do it at a pretty high level, pretty consistently, they're a tackle. Now to move inside to guard, I think, you know, a huge thing for moving inside to guard is you have to have a certain level of play strength. And I think you have to have good hand usage, because things happen faster inside. Guys are aligned tighter on you and they're bigger and stronger than defensive ends, you know, so being able to anchor and being able to, you know, have good hand fighting skills. If you're a strong offensive tackle who's really good with your hands, but you're not quite athletic enough to, you know, mirror guys and to get to those landmarks, that to me signals guard, because those are the traits that you will need to succeed at guard. So yeah, that's how I look at it. And, you know, I think a lot of the times you see that, like Joe Tooney is a guy who comes to mind. Left tackle at NC State, he was very athletic, but it was just a physical dimension type thing. Arm length was very short. He played kind of, you know, he was like a sawed off kind of guy in terms of his frame and his build. But he was very technically sound. He had very good hands, and he just had a really good understanding of how to work underneath guys and not let guys lift him up. And then he was a very good run blocker. So like that is a transition inside, and he had a very successful transition inside. A lot of guys do. Cody Whitehair is another guy who kind of fits that mold of Joe Tooney. Man, there's so many. Mitch Morse played left tackle at Missouri. He went into center. He's had a very good career. So it's either a size thing or a movement skill thing. And then if you have good hands and you know how to manipulate leverage, you're a good run blocker, then you could play guard. So that's how, or center maybe.
What's the difference between playing somebody on the right side and the left side and knowing when you can move them or not? When do you want to, do you think that teams make mistakes in terms of projecting? Well, this guy has played on the left, but we're just going to move him over to the right because we already have a left guard or a left tackle or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, I think they definitely do make mistakes. I think it's a case by case basis, you know, really, but generally I would say moving sides is more difficult than moving positions. So left tackle to left guard isn't as difficult as left tackle to right tackle, because you have to switch what side of your body is your strength or your dominant side and which side is kind of your secondary side. It's kind of equatable to writing with the opposite hand. I mean, you kind of have to rewire a lot of ingrained movements and muscle memory. And some guys are able to do that much easier than others, but I would say that's the exception more than the norm. One of those exceptions is a guy named Elgton Jenkins, Green Bay Packers offensive lineman. He's a guy who literally can play almost any position, and he does it very effectively. That's rare, though. A lot of people kind of get caught up in, yeah, this guy has positional versatility, just move him around like it's Madden. But that's just not the case. Jenkins is one of those guys who could do it. But yeah, and the reason for that is because of how unnatural it is. And then when you get, when you start talking about veterans like Laken Tomlinson, I think he played right guard in college at Duke a little bit, but I mean, he's been in the NFL for 7-8 years now, and he's played one position, left guard. So when you have years of repetitions utilizing one dominant side of your body and, you know, all these ingrained movements and muscle memory, switching a guy like that compared to a second year player, I think is just much more difficult. So it makes sense that the Jets just came out and said, Laken Tomlinson's going to stay on the left and Elijah Vera Tucker's going to move. That makes sense to me just because of what I said, you know, but Vera Tucker doesn't have all those reps in years and years and years
yep.
playing left guard as opposed to Tomlinson. So that to me is why you would typically want to do it and how you would want to do it. You look at, you know, experience, I think, is a big factor in that.
How would you describe the difference for an offensive lineman from year one to year two? Because I've heard this described as like, sometimes this is tackle in particular is a position that needs a minute to develop, right? But like, just because it doesn't happen right away doesn't mean that that person's not your franchise guy for that position. But we've also seen some examples in recent years, like Rashawn Slater pops off the page, you know, from last year as somebody who just hit the ground and he is like one of the best guys in the league already at the position.
Yeah. Man, there's so many factors. I think oftentimes year one to year two jumps can be more significant if a guy is coming from maybe, you know, a smaller school or, you know, I think a big thing is coaching. You know, if, did he get a new offensive line coach from year one to two? Is he in the same scheme? Because I think if that's the case, if a guy is a rookie in a scheme with the same coach and he goes into the second year under the same coach in the same scheme, he's more liable to break out than a guy who has three position coaches and four schemes in his first 4 years. Mm-hmm. That's just a lot of stuff to deal with mentally. It's to where you're thinking more than reacting and you play slower. You're learning different techniques. You're not able to master anything. You're just trying to like get to, you know, like middle ground, and then it all switches on you. And by the way, you have to adjust to NFL pass rushers, different alignments, different defensive coordinators, and you don't approach game planning the same way when you switch coaches. So I always look at that kind of stuff. You know, is there any continuity for these guys? That's big for quarterback too. Because offensive line is like such a mental position, you know, there's a lot going on pre-snap that you have to digest and process and then communicate. So if, you know, the way you approach that changes, then breaking out year one to year two, maybe you need to be a little bit more patient with this guy. I think of a guy like, you know, who took a little bit of time to develop was like Deion Dawkins, left tackle for the Bills. He came from Temple, smaller school, you know, and a lot of people thought he probably needed to play guard because he's not a typical left tackle. He looks like a guard. But here we are year 4 or 5. And I think he's one of the 10 or 11 best left tackles in the league, but his first year or two, he looked like, you know, it was too big for him. But it just took some time for him, I think partly because of the lower level school. And then he also started to get some continuity as of late as well. So those are some things that I look at that I think are pretty important for, you know, just, you know, when you're trying to assign blame to a guy or figure out if he's really good or not. These are just things that I always try to think about.
You tweeted recently or responded to a tweet about how an underrated important part of wide receiver success has to do with the mental part of the game, the ability to process coverages, stuff like that, and how that is a big part of the bust rate for wide receivers when you get down to it. What is the biggest factor that you see in O-line bust rate?
Man, I would say you know, I think coaching is a big part of it, and not giving a guy continuity. That is part of it. I think maybe overlooking fundamentals and technique for physical traits and just thinking that technique is going to come. I think that could be kind of a fatal flaw.
When you look at it and go, I can fix that.
Yeah. Which coaches, I don't blame them, but at the same time, you need to be careful. Like, coaches have egos too. And they think, hey, you know, I'm an NFL offensive line coach. I've been doing this a long time. I've developed this guy, you know, just give me a guy who's big, long and strong, mean and nasty, and I could fix the rest. Sometimes that's a good approach. Sometimes that works, but I think, you know, you need a certain level of coach to do that. And, you know, you need the right offensive system to do that. Maybe having a really good quarterback who gets the ball out on time, you know, all these other factors play into that approach working. So I think that's probably one of the things that jumps out to me is, you know, kind of undervaluing a guy who is technically sound, especially in today's NFL, where I think guys don't get a lot of time practicing in full pads. They don't get a lot of attention with their technique from coaches. It's more, I think a lot of the times coaches are so focused on scheme and getting the game plan in. And, you know, offensive line coaches are run game coordinators, so they have to design the run game. So, you know, they may not get as much technique work as you think. So sometimes that can bite guys, and guys just never develop to the level that you think they'll get to. But despite being very physically talented. So I always kind of favor the guys who at least reach a baseline of athletic ability, but are very technically sound. I think their floor is higher. And even if their ceiling isn't as high, I think high floor is what you want on the offensive line, guys who could be solid or above average. And if you get an elite guy, great, obviously that's better, but I think it's a safer bet to go with the high floor guy.
I was just talking to somebody about this yesterday in terms of roster building. And since, you know, you kicked this off by saying that that was how you got into this was roster building on Madden. You didn't have to deal with, do you have to deal with the salary cap on Madden?
You eventually did have to. Yeah.
Okay. So then this is good, 'cause you have some experience in this department. I think in terms of the offensive line, you hit on something there in terms of roster building, like good enough might actually be the way to go in terms of allocating resources. I have been trying to figure out positional importance in terms of the tackle position in particular is one that I think is interesting, because looking it up, like the wins above replacement from a position group, the tackle wins above replacement rating or number is really low. It's one of the lowest on the field. And yet we've always treated the offensive tackle position like it's one of the elite positions. You want to get your left tackle, you want to get your edge rusher, you want to get your quarterback, you want to get a wide receiver. Like, these are the positions that you want to address maybe first, or make sure that you have an elite player at those positions. But then when you have that wins above replacement number being as low as it is, I'm trying to kind of wrap my brain around what that means and what the best way is to build a roster. And somebody told me they would actually rather have like five offensive linemen that were all above average rather than going and getting that one elite guy and then having like a hole somewhere else on the line. How would you go about building an offensive line with the constraints that an NFL general manager actually has? What do you prioritize?
Yeah, I mean, I obviously, if you can get an elite guy, you know, especially in the draft, most elite guys aren't hitting free agency anyway. But, you know, if you could get one of those guys in the draft, do it, you know, maybe not at the expense of a quarterback. But the reason why I think offensive tackle is so coveted is because just there's not a lot of guys who are capable of playing the position, even at an average level. You look at their 64 starting tackles every year, and I would say, man, 40% of those guys are below average, you know, like way below average, you know, like marginal even. And that, you know, that's a big reason why I think teams invest in it in the draft as highly as they do, because when you even get an average one or above average one, like that's very valuable. More like, I would say an average tackle is more valuable than an average defensive tackle, for instance. because defensive tackle is so deep. There's so many good three techniques in the NFL. Almost every team has a very good one. But whereas offensive tackle, there's not a lot of very good offensive tackles in the league. There's certainly not a lot of elite ones. So it's just the scarcity there, I think, is what drives up, you know, the investment, you know,
kind of like the quarterback position.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's such a skill-based position, offensive line in general, because pass protection is so unnatural. You're moving backwards, and it's not like defensive line where you get to move forward and you get to attack and use your physical gifts as much. Offensive line is much more technical and you have to learn it. So it's just, yeah, it's just so, I think it's so hard to play offensive line, especially tackle. So I think that's kind of why it gets driven up. And how I would build it, I mean, I think ideally, if those are the two scenarios, five above average or, you know, two elite and two okay and one bad, I would always take the five above average. But I think in an ideal world, you build it like the Cowboys have over the last few years. You have three elite players, you know, a fourth guy who's above average and a fifth guy who's like solid. That's obviously very hard to do and very rare. But you look at like the 2016 Cowboys, that might be the best offensive line I've ever watched. They had Tyron Smith at left tackle, Ronald Leary at left guard, Travis Frederick at center, Zach Martin at right guard, and they had Doug Free at right tackle. Doug Free was their weak link, and he was a solid player. So like, and they had, you know, they have maybe two Hall of Famers, an All-Pro, and then Ronald Leary was their fourth best offensive lineman, and he was a very good run blocker. So like, that's how you would ideally do it. But yeah, like generally speaking, I think the Bills approach has been very interesting. They've kind of gone that route where it's like, they always have four or five of their guys who are solid or better. They don't invest a ton of money in the position, but they do it smartly. That's a really nice way of doing it. How the Chiefs just built their offensive line this past season, they changed all five starters. Incredible job to do that. They did it via trade with Orlando Brown. They did it via the draft with Creed Humphrey and Trey Smith. And they did it via free agency with Joe Tooney. And then they had Lucas Niang come in. You know, they drafted him a couple of years ago. But, you know, so that's the thing. Andy Reid, great offensive coach, puts his guys in positions to succeed. He's a former offensive lineman. He understands how to get the most out of those guys. Andy Heck, offensive line coach, excellent offensive line coach. And then they have Patrick Mahomes, who can right a lot of wrongs for offensive linemen. So, you know, they were able to do that. So, yeah, I mean, it's fascinating all the different ways you could do it. But yeah, that's kind of how I would try to get the best players and try to get elite guys if you can. But if I had to pick, you know, between, you want to avoid having that one weak link, because defensive coordinators they'll find him and they'll design matchups to capitalize on that. And you could lose games because of having that one guy. So I would try to avoid that. Yeah.
Can't have that one. I talked to Rick Spielman on the podcast last week, and he was talking about roster building, and he talked about it in terms of the way they did was like blues and reds and yellows, and the blues were the elite players and you got a certain number of those guys financially speaking. And then reds were like starters that were legit starters that weren't the, you know, you're all pro or Pro Bowl guys. And then he said that in his study, there were Super Bowl teams, the teams that had won the Super Bowls for X number of years that he looked at, they had masked like, you know, two players. And I can't remember if it was on either side of the ball or just two players in general that weren't particularly good, but like they could mask them in their scheme and get away with it. You're saying that person, that yellow, let's say, could not be on the offensive line. You couldn't, you know, plug that guy in at right guard and get away with it.
Yeah. You want to try to avoid that. I think, you know, at all costs, you know, you look at the Rams, they didn't really have that guy. You know, they didn't have a yellow on the offensive line, I don't think. You know, they had a bunch of reds. You know, maybe Whitworth was maybe, you know, kind of a blue maybe, but more so like a high end red, you know, but the Bengals, you know, miraculously they got to the Super Bowl with multiple yellows. But that was kind of a, you know, exception rather than the rule. I think generally when you look at Super Bowl winners, they have all reds and maybe a blue. I don't see a lot of yellows when I look back. You know, you look at the 49ers and the Chiefs a few years ago in the Super Bowl, and what Nick Bosa was able to do in that game, So even though the Chiefs won, Nick Bosa almost won that game for the 49ers. He just was dominant in that game. But if you have a Patrick Mahomes, you know, that could kind of right that wrong and overcome a yellow if you have that. But you need a Patrick Mahomes to do that, you know? So, yeah, I mean.
What about a Trent Williams? So Trent Williams, who's out there just mauling people and just total game changer on the line. Where do you value that in terms of positional value? Like, how much do you have to just continue to pay that guy, pay top of market? How much, like, is there a tipping point where it's no longer worth it? Because, or are there just outliers at every position? Like we talk about, you know, defensive interior. Well, Aaron Donald's the best player in the league. Most people don't value, you know, defensive tackle positionally as much as other positions. But like when it's him, you gotta.
Yeah. Yeah. I think Trent Williams falls into that category, honestly, especially when you have a coaching staff who can put him in positions to really maximize it like Kyle Shanahan does. That's the key. If he's in a system like that, then yeah, you pay him and you make him the highest paid guy and you just ride with it because he's a legit weapon in the run game. I mean, and there's nobody really like him. There's guys who have at times been kind of close, like Teron Armstead, you know, early in his career was incredible in the run game. Tyron Smith, you know, before the injuries caught up to them. But like, I still think Trent Williams in the run game is, I don't think there's been another left tackle in the 7-8 years I've been studying offensive line that can do what he does in the run game. He's in the perfect position to do it. And he's very good in pass protection as well. You can leave him on an island. You can, you know, allocate resources to the other offensive linemen in terms of help and, you know, schematic help and things like that. You don't have to worry about him. Yeah. I mean, I feel like a guy like that in that system it's hard to overpay that guy. For sure.
So he's one. And you mentioned Teron Armstead now with Miami, huge pickup down there. Who else is in that conversation for like those guys who are the best ones?
Yeah. I mean, I think Trent might be kind of in his own tier at this point, honestly. But like that next tier of guys who are maybe on his heels, you know, that are still maybe elite players almost is like, I think Teron Armstead is very underrated. I think the contract that Miami was able to sign him for is a steal. I mean, it's really just availability is the only knock on him, you know, and just missed games. But when he's on the field, he's a legit weapon. So he's definitely in that conversation. David Bakhtiari is probably the next guy for me. He's coming off a major knee injury, so we'll see kind of where he is. But man, you know, first team all pro there for a few years in a row. He is one of the best pass protecting tackles in the game when healthy. So to me, it's Trent Williams, David Bakhtiari, Teron Armstead, and then Rashawn Slater would probably be number four
already,
which is crazy. You know, we'll see where Ronnie Stanley is when he comes back from a major injury. I think he was kind of in that top five conversation before he got hurt, but he's missed a lot of football now. And there's questions on how he will come back. And then Tyron Smith, you still have to put in maybe like that five or six spot. Because even though he isn't what he once was, even 80-85% of Tyron Smith is one of the top 10 left tackles in the game. He's just such a freak of nature. So those would be probably my guys there. I mean, maybe Laremy Tunsil would be the next guy. That'd probably be like, what is that, 7 or 8? So, and then after that, you kind of take a step down, and then there's a lot of other guys that, you know, are out there. And then right tackle, I think it's a big three. It's Lane Johnson, same as left tackle, big three. Lane Johnson, Ryan Ramczyk, and Tristan Wirfs. Those are the elite right tackles in the league. And then after that, you got some very good ones, you know, that you could throw out there. Looking at some of my list, there's a bunch of guys, but yeah, those are the elite guys, I would say.
What about the guards? Who are the best guards?
I would say left guard. One of them just retired, Ali Marpet, who I thought was one of the three best left guards in football. Quentin Nelson is the top left guard, you know, in the league. Everybody knew it coming out of Notre Dame. He was kind of a generational prospect. You know, he went in the top 10 as a guard. And yeah, he has everything you can want at the position. Size, ideal. He's fundamentally sound. He came from one of those coaches I mentioned, Harry Heinstead. at Notre Dame. So he was extremely fundamentally sound. So when you pair elite physical traits with elite technique, you got a generational player. So Quentin Nelson is a top left guard. I thought Ali Marpet was probably the second best. He's gone. After that, Elton Jenkins, I would put up in that conversation for the top five, Joel Bentonio and maybe Joe Tooney. That'd probably be like my top five left guard, tier. And then right guard, Zach Martin is the prototype. I think he's been my favorite offensive lineman to watch over the last 8 years, is Zach Martin. He's a machine. He's just the most technically sound guy I've ever seen play offensive line. So he would be one.
How important is it that these guys are assholes on the field?
I think it's pretty important. I mean, occasionally you have a guy who's maybe not like, you know, major, you know, in that way. Like Mitchell Schwartz wasn't like a great finisher necessarily, but like kind of more of the exception than the rule. Generally, you want guys who play pissed off, who know how to finish, I would say tactically, you know, through the whistle, through the echo of the whistle, they know how to walk that line. And it's really fun to watch those guys because they get under the skin of defensive players. Ryan Jensen is the king of it at center. Zach Martin is definitely a really good finisher as well. Wyatt Teller is a really good right guard. Brandon Scherff, Shaq Mason. Those would probably be my top right guards in the league right now.
Center.
Ryan Jensen, to me, you know, I think he still gets underrated somehow. I mean, he made the Pro Bowl for the first time this year, but I think he's been the best center in the league the last couple of years. There's just nobody like him. He's physically imposing, you know, he's 6'4", 320. So he has like elite size at center. Former six round pick, you know, who's just carved out this incredible career to become the highest paid center when he signed with the Bucks, drafted by the Ravens. But man, his tenacity, his competitive toughness is just, it's just incredible to watch him on the field. He really sets the tone for an offensive line and an offense. Plus, he's smart. He makes the calls. Him and Brady work really well together pre-snap. He's outstanding. And then after that, I mean, in the same tier, Jason Kelce, who's, you know, probably going to be a Hall of Famer, really unique player as well, you know, barely 290 pounds. But man, just explosive and a fiery guy. And they use him very well in Philadelphia. They tailor things to him perfectly. Rodney Hudson is up there in age now, but man, he was elite for a long time. Frank Ragnow's kind of like a younger guy who's in that conversation, I think. And there's a guy like Eric McCoy, Ryan Kelly. Those are a couple other guys that I would kind of put in that conversation a little bit too. So those are the top guys to me.
Going back to Hudson, did the Raiders blow it?
Initially, I thought they did, and they did downgrade still. But the guy that they put in his place, his name's escaping me right now.
Andre James.
Yeah, he played tackle in college, but yeah, Andre James, he actually got progressively better last season as the season wore on. And I remember watching his last couple of games, and that looks like a solid center. So even if you went from very good elite to solid, you know, that's not bad. You saved a lot of money, obviously, so I can understand it. And then Hudson got hurt, and, you know, he's 35 or whatever he is. So I get it. But initially I was kind of like, you know, because Hudson's so smart too. And like the pre-snap thing, I was kind of like, oh man, you're losing a big piece there. But you had a veteran quarterback in Derek Carr who can maybe shoulder some of that load. And he did. And it worked out. I think it worked out okay for the Raiders, actually.
Maybe save some money that allows you to go pay Davante Adams, which obviously will be huge for them on the field. Okay, last question, since we're finishing up on center, what is the right way to draw your center when making plays?
Oh, that's a good question. I always prefer the box.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're a box guy.
Yeah. That was just more, you know, aesthetically pleasing to me to have that distinction of the box and then the circles around it with all the other linemen. So yeah, that's what I always kind of,
what is the wrong way? Like, is there a way that you see that you're like, that makes no sense to me? No. Why is that person doing
that? If you do all circles,
okay,
like for all five,
what are we doing here?
Yeah, you need kind of that break point, you know, to separate okay. It, you know, it's an odd number, you have five, you break it and then you have two on each side. It just makes sense to me.
Duly noted. Don't be a circle person. Brandon Thorne, thank you so much for your time.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure.
All right, that'll do it for this episode, and you can find more from Brandon on Twitter at BrandonThorneNFL. You can also find a link there to his newsletter, Trench Warfare, with the film sessions that I mentioned earlier with Rashawn Slater and Zion Johnson. If you could do me a favor, I'd really appreciate it if you could take a sec to rate and review the show, this show, on whatever platform you're listening to. I'm always up for any feedback that you might have, because as much as I have these conversations for selfish purposes so I can learn more from these great guests, I certainly want to make sure that you're getting what you want out of it also, and I very much appreciate you listening and subscribing. For video clips of the show and more, follow me on Twitter, Lindsay_Rhodes. I'm also on Instagram, LindsayRhodesNFL. The NFL Roadshow is part of the SiriusXM Podcast Network. The producer is Andrew Emmer. Marissa Rivas is the acting director of sports podcasts for SiriusXM. And as always, a special thanks to SiriusXM's senior vice president of sports programming and podcasting, Steve Cohen. Have a great one, everybody. We'll see you again next week.
SiriusXM Podcasts.